Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week, the nation celebrates President's Day, but instead of revisiting the lives and careers of the best presidents, like Washington and Lincoln, both of whom were born this month, we thought we would take a lighthearted but also instructive look at the worst presidents in history. Before we do that, take a moment to jot down which presidents you think should be on our list while we take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. While on vacation in New Mexico over 50 years ago, Herbert Land's daughter asked her father why she simply couldn't see a photograph of herself immediately after it was taken. The inventor, who had dropped out of Harvard in order to pursue experiments in light polarization full-time, used his daughter's intriguing question to help him invent the Polaroid Land camera during this week in 1947. The Land camera could produce black and white photos in about 60 seconds. Its initial price tag was a bit hefty, $89.50, but the camera became the hit of the 1948 Christmas season. Land later applied his talents to military surveillance photography and developed the high-powered lenses used on America's U-2 spy plane cameras, the same cameras used to take pictures of Soviet missile silos during the Cuban Missile Crisis. In 1963, Land was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He died in 1991. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, upon boarding the Titanic, it is doubtful that passenger Nellie Wallcraft ever dreamed that one of her personal letters written while on board would be among the most popular items in an auction held some 85 years later. Nevertheless, that's exactly what happened recently in England when one of her letters was auctioned off for $13,000. In the letter, Wallcraft describes her experiences aboard the doomed ocean liner, the frantic evacuation that occurred on the night of April 15, 1912, and her eventual rescue by the ship Carpathia. Sadly, over 1,500 of the 2,224 people aboard the Titanic did not survive. After nearly a century of being displayed in a Scottish museum, the ghost dance shirt of a Sioux Indian who was killed at the Battle of the Little Bighorn was recently returned to his tribal descendants in a ceremony held in Wounded Knee, South Dakota. The blood-stained cotton shirt, which is believed to be sacred in the Sioux tradition, was ripped from the body of an Indian warrior after the famous battle. It was given to a translator for Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show, who in turn sold it to a Kelvin Grove museum in 1892. Among the approximately 200 attendees of the ceremony was Cherokee attorney John Earle, who explained that with the shirt's return, a man has stopped wandering. He is home. You're listening to Talking History. Rating American presidents is one of our favorite pastimes, and whether we're amateurs or professionals, the results are usually the same. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt always head the list. But have you ever tried to compile a list of our worst presidents? Our guest today has. His name is Nathan Miller, and he's the author of Stars Spangled Men, America's 10 Worst Presidents, a book that's bound to spark some debate, much humor, and no doubt at least a little outrage. Nathan Miller, formerly an award-winning reporter for the Baltimore Sun, is the author of 14 books of history and biography, for which he's been nominated 5 times for a Pulitzer Prize. Welcome, Mr. Miller, and thank you for joining us.
I'm glad to be here, Brian.
Just how did you go about selecting your list of the 10 worst presidents? What criteria did you use?
First of all, the qualities for a great or a good president are pragmatism, strong character, vision, political skill, a basic integrity, and the ability to communicate with the American public. So therefore, the qualities for a poor president are a mirror image, bad character, the inability to compromise, a lack of vision, poor political skills, dishonesty, and an inability to communicate.
So it might be that they either did something bad or did nothing at all.
That's correct. In most cases, it's a failure of character. Heraclitus, the Greek philosopher, once said, character is fate. And in some of these men, character was fake.
Okay. Well, we're not going to have time to go through the entire list, or at least to talk about them at great length, although we'll want to mention them all. But let's start sort of at the top of the list, or the bottom, depending on how you look at it. You are number one, which is to say the best of the worst, and that's Jimmy Carter. Why'd you choose him?
Well, Jimmy Carter is a classic example of a man who knew how to run for president, how to be elected president, but didn't know how to be president once he got the job. A lot of people have objected to my inclusion of Carter in this list. They point to his post-presidential career. I grant you that Carter is probably one of the better men we ever had as an ex-president, but that does not mitigate his presidential term, which was something of a disaster. I think that when he left office, the inflation rate was higher than his popularity rating.
Now, you have a little rejoinder next to Jimmy Carter, you say, who showed that the White House is not the place for on-the-job training, which I think you've just explained. But for your second person on the list, William Howard Taft, you say he got so fat that he got stuck in a White House bathtub. Is that why he made your list?
Sort of an amusing incident on Taft's career, but that's not why he's on the
list.
He's on the list primarily because he serves as a trough between two near-great presidents, Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. The country was in a progressive mood, a liberal mood. Taft was very much a conservative. He did not reflect the needs or wishes of the nation of the time, and he failed as a president.
Is it important, do you think, just as an aside, that in order to be a good president, that you have to reflect sort of the interests and the will of the people?
No, one should be a leader. One should show leadership in the presidency. A perfect example of leadership, of course, is Franklin Roosevelt. The country was in the throes of the Great Depression, and he mobilized the country. Roosevelt, of course, did not end the Great Depression. World War II did that, but he at least gave the country a sense of mission. Ronald Reagan, who's not on my list, a number of people objected to the fact that he's not on my list, also had a sense of mission and leadership.
Okay.
People may not have liked where Ronald Reagan led the nation, but he did have a sense of where he wanted to go.
Okay, good. Well, now Benjamin Harrison is number three, and you write, he looked like a medieval gnome and had a handshake like a wilted petunia.
Yes, he was very much a non-entity. He was elected primarily because he was the grandson of William Henry Harrison, the previous president. Incidentally, William Henry Harrison died a month after giving his inaugural speech. Benjamin Harrison served 4 years, and he probably accomplished just about as much in his 4 years as his grandfather had accomplished in 1 month.
You have no mercy. Okay, now Calvin Coolidge, your number four.
Calvin Coolidge is sort of an amusing case. He succeeded Warren D'Amelio Harding, who's much further down on my list. And Coolidge's policy was to do absolutely nothing. He sat in a rocking chair in the White House lawn and smoked 50-cent cigars. The stock market shot out of all proportion, just as we're having today. A great sense of speculation. People were getting rich overnight. Coolidge did nothing to head off the danger, and immediately after he left office, of course, the bottom dropped out of the Great Depression, and Herbert Hoover, who had been Secretary of Commerce under Coolidge, and had been warning that something was going to happen if something was not done, bore the brunt of the blame for the Great Depression, although he was really not to blame for it.
So maybe his platform of keeping cool with Coolidge didn't do the country any great service.
No, it did not. They should have a more activist presidency would have probably served the country much better at the time.
And I love, for the benefit of the listeners here, your rejoinder to Coolidge, which says he was the living embodiment of Woody Allen's observation that 80% of success is showing up.
Yes, he showed up, and that's about it.
Okay. Number five, Ulysses S. Grant, who proves that old soldiers should fade away rather than go to the White House.
Yes, Grant, of course, is a tragic case. Grant had been a great soldier. He had won the Civil War. He had been rewarded with the presidency, and he was another man who did not know how to be president once he got the job. In fact, he never voted in an election except in one case, and he was a Republican candidate and Republican president, and he had voted for a Democrat the only time that he was voted for the presidency. He had no idea of how to be president. He was surrounded by men who were scallywags and crooks, and they proceeded to strip away the dome of the Capitol.
So perhaps you're a man who just simply couldn't control or even deal with what was going on around him.
Right. He had no interest in being president.
Okay.
He wanted the job to be president. He wanted the honor. He had no interest in being president.
Now, number six, we come to the first person who perhaps was most obvious on, or most likely to be included on most people's list because he was the first president to be impeached, Andrew Johnson. Tell us about him a bit.
Johnson's a classic case of a man who lacked the temperament to be president. He's an angry man. He could not stand criticism. You know, his policy was a failure. His policy was to bring to restore the Democratic leadership in the South that had led the South to the war. He hoped to use these people to get himself reelected as president in 1868. I'm going to jump back a bit. He'd come to the presidency in 1865 after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, and he had no political following of his own as a vice president, and he wanted to build a political machine, and he thought he could build it in the South. Of course, in doing that, he sacrificed the rights of the freed slaves.
Now, many people think that he was framed. They look at impeachment and see it as strictly a political action. Do you agree with that?
Yes, impeachments are political. Politics is politics. I mean, Clinton's impeachment was politics. Johnson's was politics. But in Johnson's case, I think that the grounds were more solid for the impeachment process.
Number seven, Franklin Pierce.
Franklin Pierce and James Buchanan, who are the next two presidents, really, on my list, are complete non-entities. The country was heading for a breakup in the Civil War. These two men served as presidents before the Civil War. They had no idea how to govern, what to do, how to bind up the differences in the nation, and they exacerbated by their failures the situation and made the conflict irrepressible.
Now, you wrote of Franklin Pierce, there's nothing left but to get drunk, quote-unquote, after being denied renomination and promptly did so. Was he noted for his drinking?
He was, as one writer said, a veteran of the innumerable losing battles with the bottle.
Now, you mentioned Buchanan already, but you what's the reference here to being on the government payroll for 40 years and never having an original idea?
Well, he had been everything from congressman to secretary of state to minister to Britain, and a party wheel horse primarily, without ideas, without imagination. And some writers claim that he was the nation's only gay president.
Oh, really?
Now, there's no proof of this, of course. Mm-hmm. He was a bachelor, and there's no proof, but he is sometimes cited as that. In fact, some gay people do cite him as a gay president. I remember Barney Frank, the congressman from Massachusetts, who was avowedly gay, has cited Buchanan as a gay president.
Do you, I think those who might contend with you here might ask, well, could Buchanan really have stopped or headed off the Civil War?
No, he might not have headed off the Civil War, but he might have done more to prevent it from happening.
Well, you have a phrase here that comes close to an idea you just mentioned, Warren Harding, who gave being in the closet a new meaning.
But yes, poor Harding. Harding was another non-entity elected to the presidency in 1920 after the end of World War One. People had revolted against progressivism, they revolted against internationalism as espoused by Woodrow Wilson, the League of Nations. People just wanted to be left alone, and Harding sort of epitomized this idea of laissez-faire, get along, let go along. And he was a small-town Ohio editor without ideas, and he brought a group of friends with him from Ohio who proceeded to loot the treasury. Harding is reputed to have had a young girlfriend, which he brought into the White House. There's no proof of this either, except her statements. She really wrote a book about it.
Right.
And she claimed to have had assignations with him in a closet off the Oval Office.
So the reference to closet is a little bit different from how we might apply it to
rumors
about Buchanan. Okay, well, I suppose we should have a drum roll here, but in absence of that, we get to the bottom or the top of the list, depending on how you want to look at it. You are worst president of all time, and I'm sure there's going to be some screaming about this, but you pick Richard Milhouse Nixon.
Yes. In fact, I sometimes have doubts in my own mind whether Nixon gloves on this. Nixon was a very able man, one of the more intelligent men to become president, who really had a lot of accomplishments in his presidency. And particularly in the field of foreign policy, his agreements with the Russians, his opening towards China. And I think probably history will probably treat Nixon much kinder than we do today. But he is the author of Watergate. He did try to make off with the Constitution. And he is the only president forced to resign because of his crimes. And if Gerald Ford had not pardoned him, he might well have stood the chance of going to jail.
Do you think the public in the future will see him differently from historians?
I think possibly the people will look more kindly upon Nixon. In fact, I'm almost convinced of it. I think this happens. Political reputations, presidential reputations go up and down. Franklin Roosevelt's reputation went down after World War II. When people were dissatisfied with the Yalta Settlement, of course, it swung the other way and out its way up. I think a president whose reputation is really undergoing change now is Lyndon Johnson. Mm-hmm. At the time he left office, his reputation was way down because of the Vietnam War. And further and further we get away from Vietnam, people are beginning to see the other accomplishments of the Johnson years, and his reputation is starting to go up.
Now, presidents that are ordinarily listed near the bottom of ratings, like John Tyler and Millard Fillmore, are both missing from your list.
Yes.
Why did you leave them off?
I looked at them and I thought these were obvious candidates because they're always on the list of worst presidents. It's conventional wisdom. And then I looked at them and I decided they really weren't so bad. Both men were vice presidents who came to office after the deaths of their predecessors. In fact, John Tyler was the first vice president to come to office after the death of his predecessor, and he had a long-running battle with Congress about whether he was really the president or not. And he did manage to accomplish a few things. He managed to bring about the annexation of Texas and the settlement of a very serious border problem with the British over the border with Canada, and therefore I thought under those circumstances he did not belong on this list. In the case of Fillmore, he helped bring about the Compromise of 1850, which stemmed off the Civil War for 10 years, and I thought, therefore, that he shouldn't be on this list.
Well, finally, I shouldn't let you go without giving you a chance to look ahead a bit for the next edition of the 10 Worst Presidents. Will Bill Clinton be on the list?
Well, I'm sorely tempted. In the paperback version of the book, I have an essay on Clinton. I originally wrote the book, of course, before the Monica Lewinsky affair. And I wrote, the paperback came out during the affair, and I had to reassess Clinton. I originally had given him a free ride because he was the incumbent. But I had to take a new look at him, and I would say this. I don't think that Clinton belongs on a list of 10 worst presidents on the basis of what he's accomplished. He's had a few successes, and more failures than successes, but I don't think he belongs on this list. However, his character is so poor, and the contumely that he has cast upon the presidency and the picture that he has created of the presidency in the public mind, the betrayal of the public, I would possibly make him a candidate for it, and I think that I don't think, therefore, that his standing among presidents will be very high, although he may not be on this list of the bottom feeders.
And the bottom feeders, I like the phrase. Do you think that it will make a difference as the public versus historians view him?
I think that the public and the historians both agree now on Clinton, that it's a sad failure. It's a tragedy in its own way. Here's a man who had portents of greatness, who came to power at a time when people wanted change. He had the intelligence to do these things and just failed because he was an adolescent.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Miller, for a most amusing and provocative book and talk.
Thank you very much.
I hope you'll join us again.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Nathan Miller, author of Star Spangled Men, America's 10 Worst Presidents, published by Touchstone Books, a division of Simon & Schuster. And this is Talking History.
George Washington was the first you see. He once chopped out a cherry tree. President number two was C. John Adams, and then number three. John Jefferson stayed up to write the Constitution late at night. So he and his wife had a great big fight, and she made him sleep on the couch all night. King Madison never had a son, and he told the war of England. Kingsman was from lots of notes, but bigger than Pinocchio.
Next to the American presidents we celebrate this week, and about the worst of which you just heard, perhaps no other institution is the subject of more myths than the FBI and its legendary leader, J. Edgar Hoover. Here to talk about the negative myths that have grown up around Hoover and the FBI is Susan Rosenfeld. Rosenfeld, a former college professor, served for nearly 9 years as the FBI's official historian. She's currently an author, consultant, and editor, and is in the process of completing a much-anticipated book she has titled Democracy's Demons, Who Spies in America?
The Branch Davidian compound hadn't cooled before Americans asked, did the Federal Bureau of Investigation start the fire? And they are still asking. Having studied the FBI for almost two decades, I find the idea preposterous. Too many scholars and journalists remember only Bureau misdeeds. They prefer to believe the worst about the FBI. Let's examine one myth and some assumptions feeding that attitude, that Director J. Edgar Hoover's racism determined how the FBI handled black civil rights. Assumption one, Hoover's FBI had no real black agents, or if it did, it was only because of Attorney General Bobby Kennedy. The fact, from Hoover's appointment as director in 1924, several black agents conducted investigations, carried weapons, and were evaluated just like white agents. The FBI began actively recruiting minorities when the Kennedy administration encouraged government-wide diversification. By Hoover's death in 1972, the Bureau had over 60 black agents. Assumption 2. Hoover refused to alienate racist local police. The facts? Cooperation was important. Nevertheless, FBI agents in the South aggressively investigated racially motivated bombings and the murders of Medgar Evers and Goodwin Schwerner and Cheney. Assumption 3. Hoover's agents just stood around taking notes when civil rights demonstrators were attacked. The fact, although individual agents did help demonstrators and black communities threatened by the Klan, that allegation is true, but not because either Hoover or the agents were prejudiced, although they may well have been. The FBI isn't supposed to protect. Under federalism, that's the job of local law enforcement. Nationally, only the marshals of the military have protection authority, and only when an attorney general or president, not an FBI director, orders it. Refusing civil rights protection, except in the most dire situations, was explicit Kennedy administration policy. The FBI's official role was to observe and take notes that could be used in prosecution. Hoover's personal opinion may have coincided with administration policy, but administration policy it was. Assumption 4. Hoover hated Martin Luther King. Also true. Hoover did his best to discredit him. But this inexcusable campaign came from King's refusal to kowtow to Hoover, not because the director opposed civil rights. Returning to Waco, I watched on live television a flame shot up from three separate spots inside the building, so I know the FBI didn't start the fire. We should refocus from the dark questions. Then we could better evaluate the changes the FBI made after that tragedy, as demonstrated in the Montana Freeman siege. Instead of assuming the worst, let's try this, which I believe is true. FBI agents try their best to work legally and constitutionally to catch criminals and to prevent espionage and terrorism. Let's not allow unproved assumptions to hinder their work.
You've been listening to Susan Rosenfeld, former historian for the FBI. This is Talking History.
John Quincy Adams was number six in the Andrew Jackson, but you can't show Jackson worth to play politics next time he's the one that the country picks. Martin Van Buren, number eight, small one, jump shot at 10 foot 6. William Harrison, how you phrase, that guy was dead in 30 days. John Tyler, he liked country folk, and after him came president folk. Zachary Taylor liked to smoke his breath, shield friends whenever he spoke.
For our site of the week, we extend our discussion of the nation's presidents to include the first ladies, whose influence on their husbands should never be underestimated, and about whom we know less than we should. Here to tell you about one place you can learn more about the nation's first ladies is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
All of the presidents have libraries, and now there is a library in honor of the nation's first lady. The National First Ladies Library, located in Canton, Ohio, was dedicated in June of 1998 and was designed to create a central location where people can explore the lives of the First Ladies and their contributions to our nation's history. For instance, did you know Martha Washington was an excellent equestrian who rode along from camp to camp delivering messages to troops during the American Revolution? The Education Center is located in a restored Victorian house built in the mid-1800s and was once the home of President and Mrs. McKinley during his 14 years in the U.S. Senate. It is ornately decorated with historically reproduced wallpaper and antique pieces from the turn of the century. Volunteer guides dressed as presidents' wives greet visitors who then take a guided walking tour. For more information about the National First Ladies Library, contact the Canton Stark County Convention and Visitors Bureau.
And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. The History Channel has two interesting programs scheduled for the end of the month. On February 27th, it will premiere The Real Albert Goering. Albert Goering, the younger brother of the more famous or infamous Hermann Goering, conducted an extraordinary series of rescue operations inside the Third Reich. Using his influence and family connections, he repeatedly saved victims from the tyranny that his own brother helped to create. The Real Albert Goering will air on Sunday, February 27th. And on February 29th, as part of its Modern Marvel series, the History Channel will air Bridges, which will take you on a tour of some of man's most spectacular creations, from the aqueducts and arch bridges of ancient Rome to the beautiful and romantic spans of the Renaissance to the monumental marvels of our time, like the Brooklyn Bridge and the Golden Gate. Be sure to check your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we'll take a look at the history of one of the most popular forms of American music, rhythm and blues. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Hey, it's the reading, it's the year of Doomerism. Young and fierce was Franklin, fierce a man without a chin. Followed next a period, then in 4 long years of Dave Buchanan, then the South Park suit who can him, and he got a civil war. Onward, and found the king. Up to that comes old Abe Lincoln, there's a guy who's really thinking that the United States of shrinking, save the ship of faith from sinking. Andrew Johnson's next, he has a fighting set. Congress thinks good and peace, and so the country now elects Ulysses Simpson Grant, who was green and raven red. Well, drinking whiskey over risky, cause he's failing on his hat. It's 1877, and the Democrats would gloat, but they're all amazed when Rutherford Hayes wins by just one vote. James Garfield, someone really hated, cause he was assassinated. But we're all forgets and faded, 4 years later he was traded. For so quickly, the really fat, he left his wife as a Democrat. And Benjamin Harrison, that's his fat, it's Virgin McKinley up the fat. Teddy Roosevelt charged up San Juan Hill, as President Taft, he got the bill. In 1913, Woodrow, well, some takers into World War I.